Okay, members, good morning. I'm going to call the Committee on Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. Ms. Hansen, will you please take the roll?
Of course. Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner. Lead Albright.
Good morning. Present.
Good morning. Representative Burkle.
Present.
I'm sorry. Nope. Representative Burkle. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen. Representative Keel. I know you're here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, my mute.
Oh, okay, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Present.
Thank
it's
you.
Friday.
Yes, it is. Representative Mohler.
Present.
Representative Knorr.
Present.
Thank you. Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Thank you. Representative Pinto. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Present.
Good morning. Representative Sandel.
Present.
And Representative Schumacher will be joining us shortly.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. We have a quorum. Let's see. Representative Sandel, would you like to move the minutes from March 4th?
Madam Chair, I have read the minutes and move their adoption. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sandel moves the minutes from March 4th. Any questions, concerns, discussion? Hearing none. Representative Sandel moves the minutes from March 4th, 2021. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails and the minutes from March 4th are adopted. Okay, members, today we're going to continue our discussion of the PCA framework with Representative Lippert's bill, and then we have a few more bills after that. We are going to be meeting next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday to hear more bills. We also may be meeting Wednesday evening, extending our morning committee hearing at 6 p.m., so please put that on your calendar for Wednesday at 6 p.m., and I know the agenda, I believe, is already posted for next Tuesday. So, members, the first item on our agenda is House File 663. I'll be laying House File 663 over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. Representative Lippert, welcome to the committee. Looks like you have two amendments on your bill. The
yes.
First one is the A1 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment?
I would like the committee to take up the amendment, yes.
Okay, I will move the A1 amendment. Sorry, you're not on my committee. I will move the A1 amendment to House File 661, or 663, sorry. Do you want to describe the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Very simply, the A1 amendment has a few technical changes, and then make sure that the integrity initiatives in Article 1 carry over after the CSS transition.
Okay, any questions from members for the A1 amendment? Okay, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. And Representative Lippert, looks like you have an A2 amendment. I'll move the A2 amendment. Would you like to tell us about the A2?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment fills in the component values of the rate framework. It adds cost reporting language and adds a study of direct care workers who use public assistance programs. And Christy Grom or Elise Bailey can speak to it if needed.
Okay, are there any questions on the A2 for the author or for DHS? Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, Representative Lippert, I note that you are making a distinction between the rate methodologies between CFSS and PCA. I'm wondering if you could articulate the differences.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Albright. And I will ask Christy Grom if she would, I think she'd be able to more clearly articulate those differences.
Ms. Graham, sure. Ms. Graham, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Christy Graham. I'm with the Department of Human Services. The Personal Care Assistance Program, as it is, will be transitioning to a new version of that program called Community First Services and Supports, and that will begin to occur this fall, I believe, in the fall of 2021. There are a lot of similarities across both of those programs. There's a few differences. The CFSS program offers more self-directed options. It also allows for reimbursement for parents of minors and spouses to provide PCA or those services to people. And there's a variety of other kind of differences that we can, I can bring back to you to get more detail. Otherwise, we have Ms. Natasha Merz, I believe, on the Zoom as well, and she can answer additional questions on the differences between those programs. In terms of the rates are the same. They will transition to the same rate, no matter what it is.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, I also note that there are a lot of moving dates for when these indexes will be updated. And it seems to me, and this is getting into the weeds, but why are they not being updated concurrently, or are they being changed alternately? It seems like we've got kind of a one and then the other and then back to the other type of a scenario playing out here, if I'm reading it correctly.
Ms. Graham.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I think I will maybe turn it over to my colleague, Ms. Elise Bailey, to walk through some of those changes in the amendment. They are fairly technical, so I think she could better speak to those than I can.
Ms. Bailey?
Chair Schultz and Representative Albright and members of the committee, my name is Elise Bailey. I'm the Fiscal Policy Director for the department. The change that you're referencing in this amendment will change the inflationary updates to align with the inflationary updates that we do for other home and community-based services that the department provides or administers under the disability waiver rate system. Previous versions of this bill had the inflationary updates at a different schedule, and this would enable it to coincide with that.
Thank you, Ms. Bailey. Representative Albright.
Thank you. It's a fairly substantial amendment. I just have one final question, and whether Representative Lippert wants to answer it or if his testifiers, but I noticed that there's a provision that directs DHS to study the workers and whether they are utilizing other public programs, you know, given, you know, our understanding about MA or MFIP. I'm just wondering what inclusion that will have in your consideration of reporting back to the legislature. What do you intend, what hope is there for that study? What do you hope to arrive at or achieve?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Albright. So I'll just offer quickly and then Ms. Graham can respond too. So the intent, as I understand it, is just to study the extent to which there's that low pay for PCA services is leading to those workers accessing other DHS services, just to try to provide clarity for the legislature on that reality. But I'll ask Ms. Graham to respond to.
Ms. Graham, do you have anything to add to that?
Madam Chair, Representative, Representative Lippert handled the question. Well, I think we have some preliminary data that indicates that direct support professionals are utilizing Minnesota healthcare programs. And we want to make sure we're understanding that aspect and understand if they're utilizing our economic assistance programs and maybe just understand better how that plays into their wages and the rates that we provide.
Thank you, Ms. Graham.
We'd definitely be happy to provide information to the CU following that study.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be good information, I think, as follow-up from the agency.
It will be interesting to see that report if this bill passes. So let's see. So I'm going to renew my motion to Move the A2 amendment for House File 663. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails, and 663 is now amended with the A2. Okay, Representative Lippard, to your underlying bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For Minnesota to be a state that works for everyone, we need to ensure that people with disabilities and older adults can access the care that they need. This is a matter of human dignity, and sometimes it's a matter of life and death. There are 44,000 Minnesotans with disabilities and older adults who access PCA services. There are 55,000 Minnesotans who work as PCAs. Of these care providers, 82% are women and 62% are people of color. According to a 2020 legislative report, though, the average PCA makes $12.38 per hour, and this results in high turnover, reducing the quality of care, and creating instability in the lives of people with disabilities and older adults, too. There are PCAs who work multiple jobs and still are living at the edge of poverty. To stabilize this workforce, we're going to need a rate framework that provides a living wage for PCAs moving forward, and that's what this bill does. This bill has two parts. First is the rate framework. This legislation establishes a cost-based, data-driven rate framework for PCA services. It utilizes data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics to build a reimbursement rate based on current wage data. It develops a competitive workforce factor to make sure PCA wages are keeping up with similarly situated workers in the private economy. And it recognizes the non-wage costs of providing PCA services like employment taxes, workers' comp, unemployment insurance, paid time off, and training. The second part of the bill addresses program integrity measures. These include raising provider enrollment standards to ensure new PCA agencies support best practices in accounting, record keeping, and compliance, increasing the frequency with which providers need to demonstrate basic compliance with bond, insurance, and other program participant requirements, enhancing the communication between the DHS Provider Enrollment Division and the Office of the Inspector General to demonstrate continued compliance is investigated while bond and insurance coverage may still exist, and implementing quality standards for all provider agencies that will add value to program participants. The financial impact of the rate framework, as amended with these component values in place, would be approximately $290 million per year in state costs starting in 2023. This bill will positively impact 100,000 Minnesotans who need PCA services, who provide PCA services, and their families too. It will benefit some of the most vulnerable Minnesotans while valuing workers who are offering essential care and deserve a living wage for their efforts, their compassion, and their skill. At this time, Madam Chair, I'll turn to the testifiers for the bill.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. The first testifier is Peng Vang. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, then proceed with your testimony.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Hi, my name is Peng Vang, and I am the treasurer for the Minnesota First Provider Alliance. So, Madam Chair and committee members, as I stated, my name is Peng Vang, and I run a minority-owned PCA agency, Rainbow Healthcare, located here in St. Paul. For the last 15 years, I provide both traditional and PCA choice services to approximately 200 minority PCA recipients in the Twin Cities area. The culturally specific needs of my client are many, including verbal and written language barriers, and require me to provide other services beyond that of a PCA provider agency. 80% of my PCA clients live in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Of the 44,000 people receiving PCA services, 73% live in the 7-county metro area. For the past several years, Provider Alliance has advocated for increased wages for PCAs to establish best practices and higher integrity standards in our industry. The Provider Alliance believes strongly that the PCA program is one of the most cost-effective service delivery models for individuals with disabilities and older Minnesotans, and likely saves the state tens of millions of dollars a year by keeping individuals in their homes and out of higher-cost care settings. The PCA program is one of the most diverse long-term service and support programs in Minnesota. Of the approximately 44,000 people who access the PCA program, 62% are individuals who are Black, Indigenous, or people of color. The PCA program offers a culturally appropriate service that allows for community members to support each other. Most of the PCA workers are made up of women and people of color. Therefore, there's a need for diversity in skilled caregiving for people with disabilities and older adults can be regarded as an equity issue. People with disabilities and older adults who rely on PCA services to live, work, and participate in their communities are facing a severe shortage of workers to provide these essential services. The difficulty in finding and retaining PCA workers put people who rely on these services at risk of neglect and hospitalization. PCA rates have not kept pace with other comparable home and community-based services. Services that provide similar levels of direct care activities as PCA services are paid at minimum 40% higher in the disability waivers. In the governor's proposal addressing the much-needed PCA wage increases under the collective bargaining agreement with the SEIU would be just one step in addressing the workforce shortage. The next step is the adequate reimbursement funding that is needed for the agreement. The CBA will give a 15% increase to wages, bringing the floor wage to $15.25 on July 1st of 2022. The reimbursement rate will only go up 7.22% or to $19.08 per hour. Not only do these rate increases fail to cover the costs of wages, they absolutely make no accommodation for increases in payroll and unemployment taxes or workers' compensation costs that are associated with a wage increase. Nor do they account for the paid time off also included in the contract or holidays that are to be paid at time and a half. The reimbursement rate for PCA is the same in both traditional PCA and choice PCA. PCA agencies will be paying out 95.10% in wages and benefits, leaving just a mere 4.9% for cost of service delivery. As the cost of wages and the cost of delivering services continue to increase, an underfunded rate will not support these higher wages and force many PCA agencies, including BIPOC-owned agencies like mine, to close, leaving only a handful of large nonprofit organizations to meet the needs of all PCA recipients. The unintended consequence of culturally competent agencies closing their doors is the inability of people of color to choose a provider from their own community. The Provider Alliance cautions policymakers that passing significant wage and benefit increases without an adequate increase in the state reimbursement rates could lead to the collapse of the PCA program. Further, the Provider Alliance believes a data-driven cost-based rate framework should be implemented alongside the CBA to appropriately determine the state's medical assistant reimbursement rates for PCA services. This rate framework has been in development with the Provider Alliance and other advocates, legislators, DHS staff, and representatives of the SEIU since 2018. The PCA rate framework proposal would determine PCA rates using a data-driven method similar to one already in place for other like services that use a disability waiver rate system. PCA reimbursement rates would be determined by collecting data on work experience rates, requirements, pay rates, and administrative costs. Thank you, Representative Liebert, for bringing this bill, and thank you for letting me speak today.
Thank you, Ms. Vang, for testifying and for all the great work you're doing in our communities. We appreciate that. The next testifier is Tim Benjamin. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Hello.
Hi, Mr. Benjamin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Tim Benjamin. I'm a columnist with Access Press, a statewide disability newspaper, where I served as executive director for 20 years. I was diagnosed quadriplegic in 1974 when I was 21 after diving off an unfamiliar dock into a shallow lake just north of the Twin Cities. After a six-month stay at the U of M, I went home with my parents, along with my younger brother and sister, who gave up much of their independence to take care of me without help, outside help, for several years. After those years, I applied for and was fortunate to get 24-hour care a day because of a respiratory difficulty. I'm unable to clear my throat and need help many times a day just to keep breathing. I also have no use of my hands or legs, and so I need assistance with activities of daily living. But because of the PCA help I receive, I have been able to live independently, get an education, marry, and work full-time as a professional job. I also been a longtime advocate for civil rights of people with disabilities. I've tried to pay it forward and help other individuals with disabilities to live a more independent, fulfilling lives. But since the mid-90s, it has been very difficult for agencies who manage my care and for me to hire and retain PCAs. What has changed over the years, making things even more difficult? Three major factors. The PCA program at DHS has paid very low reimbursement rates for many years. The agencies are unable to afford to pay the wages and benefits comparable with other jobs requiring similar education and training. PCAs are asked to do a broad range of tasks in an environment where they are responsible for people's lives and health without substantial training and with little oversight. These have been extremely difficult times for myself and for my friends and for the PCAs. I personally know many agencies that have gone out of business in the past few years because of the low reimbursement rate. It's a never-ending struggle for my agency to find qualified, dependable PCAs who are only paid wages of about $13 per hour to provide my cares. For many hours a week, no one is scheduled to come to help me, which leaves my wife to provide many hours of essential care. But during those hours when I have no staff, I must stay in bed. I'm unable to get up, get dressed, and work, or even take a shower. In other words, by not having PCA support, I am unable to be the productive citizen I've always been proud of being. One answer for someone like me is just to put me in a nursing home. But I remind you that study after study in Minnesota and in Washington, D.C. has found that it's cheaper for a person with needs like mine to get care in the home rather than in a congregate care facility. I urge you to vote in favor of Representative Lippert's bill, House File 663. Which will provide actual data on the business costs and provide PCA services, cost of providing PCA services, including comparable jobs in this economy. This data will then be available to set PCA rates so that people like me can continue to live in my home, be productive, and cost less than congregate care. We cannot let the PCA program fail, but it has been dying a slow death for many years. The legislature must do something major to establish a framework based on real data to set the reimbursement rates. You know, one thing that I and so many people with disabilities have heard over the years is, I don't know how you do it. I don't think I could do what you do. You're a real inspiration. Well, all of you here are people with considerable energy, motivation, and dedication to serving others. I know you could do what I've done, but I guarantee you that neither you nor I could do what I have done without the PCA program. Please do not let it die. Thank you for allowing me to speak with you, and thank you for your support of the health and dignity of disabled Minnesotans. And thank you, Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Mr. Benjamin. And thank you for being with us today and explaining your situation and the value of PCAs and the issue we're trying to fix, which is their low wage and the PCA shortage. We appreciate all the advocacy you're doing. Okay, the next testifier is Dolores Flynn. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, then proceed.
Dolores Flynn, and I live in Roseville, Minnesota. And I'm a member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. So good morning, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. I provide home care services to my 50-year-old son. who needs complex 24-hour-a-day care. He suffered a head injury at age 2. In 2001, after 54 brain surgeries, he had a massive brain hemorrhage that left him a total care patient. He requires assistance in all of his daily living skills. He can do nothing for himself. SEIU home care workers support House File 663 because our PCA rate system should respond to the job market. Thousands of people with disabilities and seniors struggle to find anyone or keep anyone to do this critical work. Working with legislators from both parties, SEIU home care workers have won rate increases with our last three contracts. We are working with you this session to fund our recent tentative agreement, which brings the wage floor for PCAs up to $15.25 an hour and makes other important improvements. Just this morning, we had an overwhelming bipartisan vote in the state government committee to ratify our contract. I am proud to have served on the bargaining team that negotiated this agreement with the state and to have served on our home care bargaining team for two other previous rounds of collective bargaining as well. This bill, House File 663, would provide for rate increases as economic data demonstrates increased demand for home care services. It would help address the critical shortage of home care workers, and it's in crisis. As a parent of an adult who needs care, I worry a lot about worker shortages. We're down 3 now during the COVID crisis. I worry about who will care for my son when I'm not able to. Caregivers so often move on to jobs that provide more stability, like better wages, benefits, long-term career choices. We need to take seriously that not making these investments removes choices for the disabled and the elderly people about where they live, who cares for them, how they get about in the communities. If the care crisis we are now in continues, or even gets worse, which I believe it will, how many more people will struggle to have their needs met? Thousands more will struggle to survive if we continue to lose workers. If my son did not have 24-hour-a-day care provided by SEIU home care workers, he would need to be in some dark, dreary facility, not getting his needs met, and he would probably die within 24 to 48 hours. That's a travesty. Obviously, we want to make sure the details of the bill for home care workers. Wait a minute. Obviously, we want to make sure the details of the bill work for home care workers and the people we serve. We want to make sure that our union can bargain over how the rate increases get converted into tangible wages and benefits for workers. We want to make sure that the rate increases set a floor for state investments in home care, not a ceiling. We thank the authors and the providers for the language in Article 2, Section 3, Subdivision 9, which seeks to provide that clarity. We have asked MMB and DHS to make sure it does, and we are waiting for their feedback. Since this bill is being laid over, we will continue to work with the state agencies and the bill authors to get that clarity. But it is essential that we get it to make sure workers' hard-won rights to collective bargaining is not unintentionally undermined by this legislation. We also want the transition from one rate system to another to go smoothly. We do not want it to interfere with our contracts, and it should work with the regular cycle of negotiations. We think the current language does, but again, we would welcome confirmation with MMB and DHS. To fully address the needs of seniors and the disabled people in Minnesota, we have a long way to go. We would like to thank Representative Lippert for a good start. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flynn. Last testifier is John Dam. please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is John Dom. I'm the CEO and president of Acra Home Care. Good morning, Chair Schultz and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. As the largest provider of home care services in Minnesota, we are here today to testify in support of House File 663 and for providing a living wage for PCAs. Personal care attendants are essential not only to Minnesotans with disabilities and older adults, but also to Minnesota's healthcare system. As you know, the home care industry helps children and adults with disabilities live in their own homes while reducing overall healthcare costs by preventing costlier out-of-home placements in congregate care settings. Without a strong workforce, we could lose these benefits for both the people we serve and the state's healthcare system. PCAs are critical to supporting older adults and Minnesotans with disabilities, and they do this work while receiving a wage that is less than you can earn per hour at the local Carpet and McDonald's. While Minnesotans' population ages and the need for caregivers increases, it is becoming increasingly challenging for ACRA to attract workers to enter this profession and work for this low wage. Ensuring an adequate workforce is one of the most significant business issues we face as we aim to help more Minnesotans. Because the healthcare coverage our clients receive is through Minnesota's Medicaid program, the rate the state will pay for services is capped by the state legislature, and these rates are barely enough to cover the cost of care. So, to increase PCA wages, it is crucial to also increase reimbursement rates. Our industry needs this PCA wage increase to remain competitive with other businesses. Thank you for your time. We greatly appreciate the governor and the legislature's support in investing in this critical program that helps tens of thousands of Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dom. Let's see, it looks like we have another amendment. Representative Knorr, would you like to offer your A3 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I just wanted to discuss my amendment.
Please proceed with the, are you moving the A3 amendment, Representative Knorr?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Knorr moves the A3 amendment. Please provide us information on the A3.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just wanted to thank Representative Lippert for this bill. We understand the struggles for many people who are struggling with their daily living activities. When you do have a PCA, it helps a lot. And quite frankly, this work that is before us looks into the methods of calculations. It also looks into how we can use the market to determine the PCA rates. Madam Chair and members, we know that the cost of living is really significant. Over the past few years, PCA rates have not gone up. In fact, the cost and expenses have gone up. I can give you a quick example. As Minneapolis moves into $15 minimum wage, there will be significant impact on this type of work. We're struggling to find workers at this time. Ms. Vang discussed clearly how this is going to have an equity-based inequities when it comes to providing services to bikers. Ms. Flynn talked about the care crisis that we're facing. And quite frankly, we do have a huge work to do. So what my amendment does is it looks into what is the current need based on the income that someone should be able to make in order to provide different types of care. We've had about the traditional PCA and PCA choice. They're all great methods of doing. And I'm glad to hear that the department is moving to CFSS by fall this year, if I'm correct. That will be a big move that we will be able to provide a service that is more broad-based, making sure that there's an equal playing field and to ensure that we apply the rating. Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure that people understand when you are earning less than a family living wage, you'll be looking for other jobs. And this is a crisis we don't want to create. This is an issue that we are all facing. I want the department I want the SEIU to also look into what is the appropriate amount for us to have on a temporary basis while we're looking into the long-term basis that we have the bill before us. This just increases a temporary process whereby we are able to quantify what will it cost to provide care? How do we provide that support? How do we provide benefits? We know that many folks don't even have regular benefits. 401k, if you're talking about long-term, if you're talking about healthcare, we're looking into other people who are receiving assistance because the income is so low that people will apply for public assistance. We have to be able to adjust our system to meet the needs of today. And that's what I'm proposing, Madam Chair. I will not be moving to get this amendment for approval today, but I want people to understand we've got a lot of work to do. And that's what we should be able to do because that's what people sent us to do and provide the services for those who need the most. So thank you, Madam Chair.
So Representative Noir, are you withdrawing your amendment, the A3 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm withdrawing my amendment.
Okay, but my understanding is the A3 would increase the rates, the rate amount in the framework temporarily until Representative Lippard's language would go into effect, but you're withdrawing that amendment, so we will not take action on it. Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you for the discussion. Members, I'm going to open it up for questions. I'm going to limit questions to one per member unless, and then we can circle back and members have more questions just to keep us on track. Any questions from members for the bill author or the testifiers? I'm not seeing any questions from members. Representative Noir?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a quick question in the bill. I know there's the section for the integrity whereby we're requiring the employees to notify the department if they have left working with the PCA agency. Just wanted to know what is the rationale for the employees to notify the department when the contract is with the PCA agencies? Are they not required to notify the department when somebody departs rather than the employee taking that responsibility?
Mrs. Grom or someone else from DHS want to help answer that? Ms. Grom, thank you.
Madam Chair, members, actually, I'm going to defer to Natasha Mers to answer that question.
Okay, Assistant Commissioner Mers. You're muted, sorry. Maybe you're not muted, but we're not hearing you.
Can you hear me now, Madam Chair?
We can, thank you, proceed. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Natasha Mers, and I am the Director of the Disability Services Division at the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair and Representative Noir, to your question, the reason why individual providers are asked to notify the department when they leave employment is related to program integrity. Individual PCA providers are enrolled, so they are enrolled as individual people and affiliated with a PCA agency. So part of the program integrity measures that the department is obligated to track and understand is ensuring that that any individual PCA doesn't work over the current monthly allowable threshold, and that the department is, and also to make sure that an individual PCA isn't double billing, and if they are, that the department has a way to track that through claims and billing process with that individual identifier for that individual personal care assistance provider. So those are some of the more details about the program integrity functions that make that notification required and important.
Thank you, Director Mers. I'm going to go to our next question, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have a question, and it really reverts back to the A3 amendment. And I'm a little bit in a quandary, curious why, if the intention is to provide better rates prior to the rate reform bill being enacted, why wouldn't we want to provide for a better or a temporary increase for these folks? I'm curious as to, I didn't quite understand what Representative Knorr stated, but having said that, I would like a follow-up based upon your interpretation of why that would not be applicable at this time.
Representative Albright, I believe your question is directed to Representative Knorr.
Yes.
But he offered the amendment and withdrew it. Representative Knorr, can you help address this question, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, the intent was to make sure that we do have analysis that needs to be done. Right now, we don't have that fiscal note that will show how much it's going to cost. And this bill is being laid over. So at least we have this conversation to figure out how much the cost, the appropriate cost that we have to increase, because we do have that obligation to ensure that people get the wage that they deserve. So that's one of the reasons that I had to pull the amendment. But this is a conversation we will have to have in this committee to figure out what is the appropriate reimbursement rate at this given time before the bill before us becomes effective.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Representative Albright?
But Madam Chair, just as a question, so on the bill in its total, I'm sure Representative Lippert is waiting for the fiscal note on the bill as it would stand prior to amendments be adopted. Wouldn't there be virtue in adding the A3 to understand the full implication of what the fiscal note would look like for the bill itself?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. So we have pretty solid solid understanding of what the rate framework with current components will cost, which is why I mentioned that in my remarks. I think there's a variety of conversations happening related to Representative Knorr's amendment and getting those numbers getting those numbers firmed up. So that just needs a little bit more time. And so that's my understanding of the positioning of the amendments today.
Yeah, Representative Albert, I'll just add that I think Representative Knorr developed the rates in his amendment and we would like to see more input from DHS on what those rates would be to be able to provide higher wages. And if we put that amendment on, I believe it may hinder the ability to get figure out the correct rate on an accurate fiscal note.
So, Madam Chair, my only question.
Go ahead, Representative Albright.
Thank you. It seems like we're, chasing our own tail on this one. I'm still curious about the rationale, but I wanted to go back to Representative Knorr's, or even possibly, I'm sorry, it might have been Representative Lippert that said, and just to confirm that his numbers, as he said, they're pretty firm around this, but he said that the current fiscal note is in the range of like $290 million.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, yes, that's correct. That's the information I received. Someone from the department or perhaps Mr. Berg might have more to share on that.
I don't believe we have a fiscal note yet, Representative Albright.
No, that's fine, Madam Chair. Just trying to firm up what Representative Lippert already kind of surmised in the bill.
I'm going to move on, but when we do have the fiscal note and if this does make an omnibus, we can have a fuller discussion then. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'll go to a statement instead of a question. Representative Albright pretty much pointed it out. But, we have these conversations over and over and over again. And we try to fix it with finances, and it doesn't work. And I think we spend a lot of time talking about the importance of caring for disabilities and their challenges. and they themselves are very active. I've had a lot of conversations, as has other members. I have one in my district that is a quadriplegic that's very active in how this works. But I'm really concerned about the fact that we don't really talk about where we're going with it rather than the importance of it. The testifiers, and I don't think there's anybody on the committee that thinks this isn't important. I think the bigger problem is that we've got to come to some kind of understanding. It is a costly program. There's no doubt about it. And certainly we want to pay people that take 24 hours to take care of somebody. It's not easy work at all. I think it's good educational work for people going into the medical system. In fact, I think it's super important. I almost wish we could mandate everybody that's going to be a doctor to work in a home and take care of somebody. It would open up eyes to doctors who say things to you at the clinic or the, you know, whatever. And God bless them. They're all very good. But it just like, oh, so how is this going to happen? So anyway, I know we got to go move along. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Keel. Thank you for that comment. I do think we all care, and we have been talking about this. And it's a priority for me to get the rape framework done, just like it was a priority to get the rape framework accomplished with DWRS, and we got it done. And now we need to do it for the PCA rape framework. And I hope you'll join me in figuring out how we can raise revenue to increase wages of the PCAs. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that was really well said. I was going to say something similar. I'm thrilled with this bill because I think it actually moves us forward, and really appreciate that Representative Lippert has dug into this and is taking it on, and to the department, of course, because this is really, you know, on the macro level, it's on the micro level. There's just so many things. But my question is, was kind of brought up by the discussion with Ms. Merce around the program integrity piece. And so my question is there any requirement of the piece of the agency, in the case of where this is through an agency, to notify the client when a PCA is no longer going to be working there? Because there have been some incidents in the past, probably not with PCAs, but with other healthcare workers, where a healthcare worker is no longer working. Say they get fired. Say they, you know, in the worst case, you know, they are, you know, caught with illegal substances or something happens. They're fired by an agency, and then the client isn't told. And there have been, you know, an incident I can think of where the person showed up and continued serving the client for illicit reasons after that occurred. So is that built into this at all, or is that something we need to deal with completely separately?
Ms. Director Merz?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. To address that question, I can give some high-level comments, and then I think we would like the opportunity to go back and follow up with the committee to make sure that we're providing the accurate information. So the short answer is that who's required to notify the person using services when an individual provider has been terminated or quit for whatever reason does depend on whether that person is using the PCA Choice program or traditional PCA services. So traditional PCA services, the agency itself is the employer of the individual worker. And if that individual worker were to be separated from employment for whatever reason, it is the agency's obligation to notify the person using services and then help them select a different provider or see if they had a different provider that they might want to bring on and affiliate. For a person that's using the PCA Choice program, they are in a joint employment relationship with their with the PCA agency, and they also have obligations as a joint employer of those workers as well. And so, in a case where a person is in the PCA Choice program and their individual worker is fired, quit, again, whatever the circumstance, it is in part up to the individual person to make a decision about hiring and firing for that individual worker, and then and they generally hold responsibility for that. And they would be responsible for working with the PCA choice provider to find alternative staff to meet needs and make sure that they have those backups available.
Director Merz. I mean, sorry, thank you for Director Merz. Chair Liebling.
No, that's, yeah, thanks for that explanation. And yeah, I know there's another bill floating around kind of connected to this issue too. And yeah, I would appreciate a little more conversation offline, just, but that's helpful. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm not seeing any more questions. So House File 663 will be late, as amended, will be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, members. I'm sorry, Representative Keel, your hand is up. Is that a new question?
Nope, sorry.
Okay, that's
okay. I will
okay.
pull it down.
I'm sorry, Representative Lippert, final comments on your bill.
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to respond to Representative Keel quickly as well, that finances has everything to do with whether we're stabilizing this workforce or not. If we're not providing adequate wages for people providing this essential care, they'll do other work. And the alternative is extremely expensive. As Mr. Benjamin said, going to a nursing facility in the status quo simply is not acceptable because there are people with disabilities, older adults not able to access care. So I thank the committee for this time and look forward to continued work on this bill.
And thank you, Representative Lippert. I know how much work you've been doing on this bill. Really appreciate it. Okay, so House File 663 as amended will be laid over for possible inclusion. Next for consideration is House File 1159. I'm going to lay over House File 1159 to be possibly included in the Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Welcome, Representative Akam. Please tell us about House File 1159.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Human Service Finance and Policy Committee. I'm here to present House File 1159, which is a bill to continue to allow parents and spouses to act as personal care attendants for their family members who qualify for personal care for the Personal Care Assistance Program. This bill is intended to serve as a temporary bridge between legislation that was enacted in the fifth special session of last year and the upcoming Community First Services and Supports Program that will be implemented later this year. As we heard about in the previous bill, we've been experiencing a workforce shortage of PCAs for years, making reliable and consistent care for a challenge for families. This issue has been compounded during the pandemic when families are uncomfortable allowing non-family members into their homes due to the risk of COVID-19. As you may recall, last October, we passed legislation allowing parents and spouses to serve as PCAs to their vulnerable family members for this very reason. Unfortunately, that legislation had an end date of February 6, 2021, even though the public health emergency is not yet over. Later this year, this problem will be permanently addressed by the new Community First Services and Supports Program within the Minnesota Department of Human Services. This bill seeks to serve as a bridge to continue our previously passed legislation through the Community First Supports, through until the Community First Supports and Services. There are a couple of testifiers that would like to speak to this bill. First is Wendy Beard.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Wendy Beard, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, then proceed with your testimony. Ms. Beard, we cannot hear you. You might have to hit star six if you're on the phone to unmute yourself.
It looks like she's unmuted.
Yep, it looks like you're unmuted, Ms. Beard. Can you hear us? We are not hearing you. We'll come back to Ms. Beard. We'll go to the next testifier. Andrea Hanick, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Andrea Hanick and I live in Duluth. And I am with the SEIU Healthcare Minnesota, and I'm actually your constituent, Chair Schultz, and it's very nice to meet you. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. Chair Schultz, members of the committee, I'm a member of the SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. Our union represents 40,000 workers in hospitals, nursing homes, clinics, and self-directed home care. On their behalf, I am here to support House File 1159. This bill would extend the time parents and of minors and spouses could be paid for personal care assistant services until the Community First services and supports is fully implemented. My boys are 8 and 9 years old, and they struggle a lot to navigate everyday life. They're incredible kids, but they need an extraordinary amount of support navigating their disabilities, which include autism, language impairment, ADHD, dyslexia, dysgraphia, and PTSD. With consistent support staff, we were just reaching a feeling of stability. When we lost these consistent supports and services due to COVID, my family suffered emotionally and mentally. Now, without their medically necessary support services in place, I must provide that support. I have to. Someone has to, and there isn't anyone else. Now, without their medically necessary services, since March of 2020, I have been doing both my parenting responsibilities and providing my boys their disability care and supports. However, that changed. I've been doing it without recognition or pay, but that changed when the legislature took action during the fifth special session, as I was allowed to be paid support staff providing care to my two children. This was the best Christmas gift my family could have received. Finally, I was being recognized for the struggles I had carried this year without support staff during the pandemic. Unfortunately, it was short-lived, and it only lasted from December 1st to February 6th, when that special approval ended. Allowing parents and spouses to be paid for support services work was truly a godsend, and please, it must continue. My boys have thrived from the consistent support provided by me, actually. Our state has been in a care crisis for years. This crisis makes it nearly impossible to find and retain in-home care providers, especially during COVID now. Our union is working to fix this crisis, but we know it won't go away overnight. There's a lot of work to be done. We need to continue to support families who are carrying this work until the system can guarantee quality in-home care providers and a living wage for those workers that care for disabled people. I ask that you please support House File 1159 so that I can be recognized and compensated for my work and take that one little thing off my plate that can really make a huge difference, which is the financial strain. It is best for my family, best for my boys, and better for the public. Thank you, Representative Acom, for authoring this bill that will make a difference for my family.
Thank you, Ms. Hanek, and it's good to meet you too. So I'm a big supporter of this bill. Thanks, Representative Acom, for bringing it forward. I know we did a lot of work on it in special session to make that extension through February 7th. It's a great bill, a good idea. And I'm sorry, we can't hear Ms. Beard. So I apologize, Ms. Beard. Ms. Representative Acom?
Madam Chair, I think she also submitted her testimony in writing, so members should have access to that document.
Thank you, Representative Acom. Are there any questions from members? Vice Chair Bonner.
Maybe more of a comment than a question. Just really wanted to thank Representative Acom. I know we were able to get this through in the special session and really fill in the gaps for these families. And I know how important it really is for each and every one of these families, and our testifiers certainly bear that out. So thank you for that attention, and thank you for making sure that we can close that gap for all of these folks.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonner. Any other questions? Closing comments, Representative Acom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I will just say is I know that this is being held over for possible inclusion. Since it has already expired, my hope is that we can continue to work to find a path forward sooner than that. So I will be continuing to work, and I appreciate the committee's ability to be here today to share about this bill.
Thank you. And we don't have a fiscal note yet. And so I'm going to lay House File 1159 over for possible inclusion. Representative Acom, did you need to comment on that?
No, the only thing I was going to say is that really for the fiscal note, my understanding it will be small, if at all, and it really is because the waivers will, instead of going to somebody outside of the home, will be paid to the parent, and so it should really be a close to a wash.
Thank you for that information, Representative Akam. We appreciate your carrying this legislation. Okay, members, so House File 1159 will be laid over. Next item is House File 446. I'm going to lay House File 446 over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. Representative Akam, please tell us about House File 446.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Increasing access to the services that support older Minnesotans and those with disabilities to remain living in their own homes and or their families or with their families for as long as possible is a goal we as lawmakers and advocates and service providers are all working toward. House File 446, brought to me by the Minnesota Home Care Association, is a specific and concrete step we can take to move in that exact direction. This bill proposes an annual adjustment to the medical assistance reimbursement rates for home health services and home health nursing services. This annual adjustment will start to move us towards a more sustainable reimbursement rate so that we as a state can increase access to these services that support older Minnesotans and those with disabilities to remain living independently in their homes and therefore avoiding needing to access more intensive and expensive services. I would like to thank the bipartisan group of legislators who have joined me in co-authors on this bill. We've worked with DHS since last session on technical assistance for the bill, and we believe they are comfortable with the current structure of the bill. And I'll now turn it over to Kathy Meserly for brief testimony.
Thank you, Representative Akam. Kathy Meserly, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed.
Chair Schultz and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Meserly, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Home Care Association, representing 140 home care agency members. At MHCA, we are acutely aware, as you all are, of the rapidly growing number of Minnesotans who, without access to home care services, would have to turn to more intensive, expensive, and currently overly stressed facility-based care. Our state budget cannot afford to provide that intensive level of care to all who need it, and it's not the preferred option. The bill before you today proposes an annual adjustment to state medical assistance reimbursement rates for home care services and home care nursing. This annual adjustment would be triggered by changes in the federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services home health care market basket. That is a forecast as to what the expected increases in costs will be for the payment year. The annual adjustment to state medical assistance rates would match the CMS percentage changes. Minnesota has done very important work updating many other healthcare reimbursement systems to include minimal, regularly scheduled adjustments to reflect what current data tells us is the true cost of the components of providing quality services. However, home care services are one of the areas where rates do not include that data-driven adjustment, and the rates remain unsustainably low. Restructuring the rate-setting system will help to increase access to care and support more Minnesotans to live as independently as possible. I will now turn it over to Camille Zender to speak briefly about her organization's experience providing home care nursing services.
Thank you, Ms. Meserly. Camille Zender is our next testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation and proceed.
Hello, my name is Camille Zender, and I am CEO with Pediatric Home Service. Chair Schultz and members of the committee, thank you for taking the time to hear this important bill. Pediatric Home Service provides hospital-at-home services, allowing children to receive the care they need in their homes with their families and to achieve their best lives in their communities across the state of Minnesota. Home care nursing is a key component to the care that our kids need. Without access to home care nursing, children remain in the hospital, medically stable and ready for discharge for extended periods because agencies like ours cannot attract enough nurses to accept new cases. There was a study conducted in the last few years across four children's hospitals in Minnesota, and it showed that discharge to home was delayed on average by 55 days due to a lack of nursing. Obviously, this comes at an exponentially higher cost to the state, but just as important to us is that it creates unnecessary risk for our kids for hospital-based complications and facility-based delays. To put a finer point on this, the Minnesota Medicaid program reimburses home care providers $41.76 per hour for complex level care provided by a registered nurse. In comparison, our agency's direct care costs are $46.71 per hour, and that is only salary, benefits, and training costs. Clearly, that math doesn't work, and it doesn't reflect the additional costs for administrative support, regulatory and compliance oversight, and the more recent additional costs triggered by the pandemic for PPE, additional staffing, overtime in order, again, to take care of our kids that comes with zero separate reimbursement. Our nurses are phenomenal. Just ask our families. Their level of skill is equal to that is required in an ICU hospital. In fact, we find ourselves to be a recruitment pool for children's hospitals in the state of Minnesota, where our nurses can earn $35 to $43 per hour, and they earn every penny of it. Despite our creative efforts, our engaging culture, and our adorable kids, this is simply a fact where we can't compete. The bill in front of you today will not fill this gap, but we believe it is an important step to show the value that home care providers bring to the healthcare continuum and to give us some assurance that future rate setting will better reflect the changing conditions in our community and those that we serve. I appreciate your time today and am happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Zender. Representative Akam, do you have a fiscal note for this bill?
Not at this point.
Okay. Let's see, questions from members for the bill author or testifiers? I'm not seeing any questions. Representative Akam, closing comments?
I thank you and the committee for the time this morning and considering this important bill.
Thank you, Representative Akam. So House File 446 will be laid over. Thank you, testifiers and Representative Akam, for presenting your bills today. The next item we have for consideration is House File 900. First, I'm going to move to adopt the Preventing Homelessness Policy Division Report. All those in favor of adopting the division report, please unmute yourself and say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
Nay.
The motion prevails. The division report is adopted. I'm going to move that House File 900 be referred to the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. Members, this bill was discussed extensively in our division. I'm Representative Keeler. The bill is before our committee. Welcome, and please tell us about House File 900. And I'm not seeing any amendments, Representative Keeler.
Correct. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's good to be back. We've been doing a lot of work over in the Preventing Homelessness Division, and I'm here today to present House File 900. We'll do this quickly because I know we're running short on time, but what this bill does is it establishes a task force around our shelter bill of rights. We all know that our shelters are extensive across the state. And the main thing is this, is we want to make sure that residents who utilize our shelters are safe. What this task force will do is it's a collaboration effort between state agencies, community organizations, shelters, and most importantly, individuals who have experienced homelessness themselves. There will be two reporting standards with this. We'll have an initial report and a final report. The idea is that we hear back from all of these efforts and hope that we can move forward with some policy in the next couple sessions. Again, we don't want this work to be siloed across the state. We want to work effectively and efficiently together. And so with that, we will move over. I have two testifiers with me to discuss this, but like Chair Schultz said, we did have an extensive conversation in this, but we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Ron Elwood, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and I am proud on behalf of Legal Aid to be invited to be part of this coalition that is supporting House File 900. House File 900 came about because of the dedication and determination of a group of people with lived experience of homelessness and residing in shelter who formed organizations known as Street Voices of Change and Freedom from the Streets. House File 900 tackles one of the last remaining, if not the last remaining, large system that is without any standards, oversight, or statutory or statewide coherence. The mission of this task force is to bring all the different people and organizations that this system touches together collaboratively to bring standards and coherence to this undeniably, if sadly, essential type of housing. The task force is also structured to ensure equal analysis of those having experienced homelessness and those providing shelter, both in Greater Minnesota and in the metro and suburban parts of the state. Finally, Legal Aid is privileged again to be working with the Coalition for the Homeless, NAMI, Align Minneapolis, Catholic Charities, Partners for Affordable Housing, Central Lutheran Church, Churches United, MICA, and Homeless Helping Homeless. And I want to thank Representative Keeler and Representative Gomez for their strong leadership on this issue. I urge the committee's support. I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Thomas, who will say also a minute very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood, and it's great to see you. I don't see you enough. And thank you for all the work you've done with Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So the next testifier I have is it Tyra Thomas?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. Ms. Thomas, please state your name and affiliation for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. My name is Tyra Thomas, and I want to thank Madam Chair and the committee members for inviting this really important conversation on how we can set a standard of care on a shelter level. We've experienced what we saw over the summer, where folks were in parks, they were outside, and folks were asked, why aren't you going to shelter? And they had traumatic experiences. This House File 900 is about collaboration between those with lived experience, shelter providers, and then also state agencies that fund those agencies. We took in great consideration in Street Voices of Change to conclude urban, suburban, and rural input on what the standard of care should happen for those who are displaced. You can be displaced for all kinds of different reasons, and shelters do save lives. Once we get those lives in our hands, the Shelter Residents Bill of Rights is talking about aftercare. How do we care for those lives so that they find their pathways home in dignity and respect? I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today, and that if there's any questions, I'm willing to yield back and answer any questions that you have. Thank you for this opportunity, and be well.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas, for your testimony, for being with us today. We appreciate it. Any questions from members for the bill author or the testifiers? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author of the bill, a series of questions. The first is really pertaining to definitions. Representative Keeler, you talk about in lines 1.16, actually starting on line 1.15, and I'll direct you to point on 1.16, when it talks about a shelter being either a fixed or a rotating location. Could you elaborate in terms of what a rotating location entails?
Representative Keeler, we could defer to Mr. Elwood. Looks like he may want to answer this. Representative Keeler, is that okay?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Mr. Elwood.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, that is really in relation to primarily shelters provided by community faith groups and churches and other religious affiliations. Because sometimes they move from church to church over time, and that is what that is referring to.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Keeler, this is not to sound trite, but when you're describing the homeless or people experiencing homelessness, and you're putting them on this a committee that quite literally has as many members as the Minnesota State Senate and more, just a mechanical question in terms of if these people are suffering homeless, How will they be notified of upcoming meetings? How will you contact those people?
Representative Keeler?
Representative Albright, that's a good question. I think that that's one of the things we all work through. The size of this is actually something that we are talking to the greater group about, because I do understand that it's a large task force. But to that note, there's a lot of people that this affects. And I think that we go back and forth between understanding, like, the project management brain in me does understand that smaller task forces work more efficiently, but there are so many voices that are important to be at this table. So we are working through that. As far as notifications, I'm going to send that over to Mr. Elwood to follow up with that.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Keeler and Representative Albright. I think what really refers to is people who have experience and who have resided in shelter doesn't necessarily limited to folks who are currently experiencing homelessness, because the folks who have already had that situation are very familiar with the experiences they've had. And I think there's been a lot of discussion, as Representative Keeler said, about narrowing the group, the numbers. And I think it's just a question of trying to make sure, as in all these things, that the proper balance is struck between those of folks who have actually have lived experience, the government providers that over, you know, that are in critically important, and the shelter providers themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. One more question, Representative Albright, because there are other members on the list.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Elwood or Representative Keeler, I'm going to direct your attention to page 5 of the bill, lines 0.24 through 0.29. Looking for a little more elaboration in terms of under that section 15, it says accommodations for residents, non-traditional work hours and schedules, circumstances involving members of the resident's immediate family who do not reside in the shelter, and other extenuating circumstances. It goes on to say reasonable accommodations for residents with disabilities, including residents with physical, developmental, and community challenges, persons whose primary language is not English, and persons with food and other allergies or dietary restrictions. That's a lot to take care of, notwithstanding the fact that I would imagine that most shelters also already have to comply with ADA. So how does that reflect upon existing law? And if you are making these accommodations, how do you, it just looks like a spider web in terms of your responsibilities, Mr. Elwood. I know your mind is much grander on a grander scheme than mine, so I'm sure you've got an explanation for me.
Mr. Elwood or Representative Keeler?
Madam Chair, I'm going to go first on this before Mr. Elwood does.
Representative Keeler.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, I think we need to remember that this is a task force to look through all of this. That's why it is a spider web. There's many, many layers to this and multiple capacities in which we need to look at. I think that some shelters are doing this very, very well. Other organizations need a little bit of work and support. And so I agree, this is big. This is big work, and it's the reason why it's so important that we do this. I'll move it over to Mr. Elwood now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Albright. I'm not sure if I have a grander mind, but I certainly have. I do have an explanation, a further explanation, and that is that these are actually coming from experiences that folks have had in shelters. So, for example, when they have a late shift and they're coming home at coming back to the shelter at 2 o'clock in the morning, sometimes they're being excluded from entering because of their work hour. This would be a non-traditional work hour. That's an example. We've had those clients actually at Legal Aid. And also situations, for example, where a resident had to leave the shelter to take care of a family member who was not living in the shelter, and again, was not permitted back into the shelter. So these were sort of examples of the kinds of things that Representative Keeler said that you're correct. It's very complicated, which is exactly why we need to bring all the stakeholders together to have these thorough discussions.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. And we're going to move on to Representative Sandell, and then we're going to move to a vote. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Keeler, I certainly support the bill and believe how important the issue is. Notice the bill suggests that the task force would get underway in August, but do you think that we might be able to put either a deadline or a suggested deadline so that legislation might be put in place that we could consider at the beginning of our 2022 session and make some progress on it?
Representative Keeler?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Sandel. That's one of the suggestions that we take into consideration why we created in the amendment that we added to this was adding an initial report for February 1st of 2022. The hope is that we stay in contact with the task force as we move through some policy that we can present in next session. We've thought that with deadlines and the schedule, February 1st would be sufficient to add some of those first options in next session.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Sandel?
Thanks. Good luck, and certainly want to support the bill. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not seeing any more questions from members. So, Representative Albright?
Thank you. Apologies. Parliamentary inquiry in terms of I don't recall if this is moving to the general register or if you're moving it on to another committee. And in conclusion, just wondering, I see there is an appropriation at the back end, and I'm wondering if there's a fiscal note that has been requested or if this is an appropriation that will be determined based upon what housing says. Is that where it's going?
Yes, it is going, Representative Albright, it is going to Housing, Finance, and Policy, and they will discuss the appropriation in that committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Keeler, closing comments. Oh, Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Keeler. I guess one of the concerns that I have with this is we obviously are dealing with a significant population that obviously is being identified as greater and greater, larger and larger. And I'm concerned that a 51-member council could come up with a lot of rights that people who are in homeless shelters are entitled to, but at the end of the day, that may drive up the costs of providing the then-defined rights of those individuals for the shelters and churches and communities that are trying to provide, literally provide physical life-saving shelter. And I'm just wondering how much thought has been brought into, while we have not enough shelters presently, how adding a Bill of Rights for these individuals, while a laudable goal, how that might impact the actual access and availability of shelters, and whether or not this might actually indeed.
We lost you, Representative Pearson, but I think we understand your comment and question. Representative Keeler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I think that those are good conversations to have. It's actually one of the pieces that we talked extensively about in preventing homelessness, and we talk about it a lot, is that, as you heard in Ms. Thomas's conversation, is that a lot of people don't feel safe going to shelters. So if they're not safe going to shelters, they're not going to utilize and access them. And so this is a combination of us coming together to understand what we're doing really well, and that we do have growth that needs to be created. I think that, like I mentioned before, the 51 piece, as far as the size, we're looking at how we can reduce that and still be effective in our work. But you bring forward great suggestions, and this is what this task force is designed to do and walk through. As we see costs come through, that's why we have shelters that are a part of this. The last thing that we want is to put shelters out of business. We just want to make sure that we're creating a safe, reliable, and effective space for individuals who need shelter to really move to next spaces and quite frankly, stay alive. Thank you.
Ms. Thomas?
Yes, I echo that sentiment. The trauma that I personally experienced at shelter, we could be having a different conversation, and me and Legal Aid would be having a different conversation with state. I came into this wanting to protest I wanted to talk about, because our group grew, Street Voices of Change grew over great concerns about what was happening and what was not happening at shelters while state taxpayers, neighbors were dedicating, donating, and giving to these organizations of shelters. And that I decided that that would not be the way to go. And that's how we are at your table now, 4 years later, with the Shelter Residents Bill of Rights. And this task force is going to bring all of those parties together to create a standard of care on the Shelter Residents Bill of Rights concept. The shelter providers, I've got great experiences and I've had bad. And if we're talking about money, it's always been a business as far as I saw it, because you have to pay to stay in some of these shelters. Taxpayers paid for us to be in those shelters. Folks donated and gave. Now it's time for us to come together to make sure that it's all accountable, that the care, the standard of care is really happening, to make sure that folks are given the space to make their way home. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quickly, it just strikes me that this is an area where we might borrow some kind of thinking from what we do in the disability arena, in the sense that the disability community, many participants came together a few years ago to start these quality councils and do an individual review. The question really is, what does quality mean to you, the person who is receiving the service? And so I really like the idea here. We're asking people who actually are on the receiving end, what does it mean to them? What do they need? What does help look like to them? And so, you know, we do that in the disability arena, and the more we do it, the more successful we are, that we can actually focus on those things that have meaning and value to the people using it. So I just wanted to throw that in, because I think that concept is helpful here, and I hope that we would come out with something like that, helping us focus our services around what people actually need, and perhaps saving money not doing stuff that doesn't work and doesn't help people.
Okay, thank you, Chair Liebling. Closing comments, Representative Keeler, you have about like 30 seconds.
Yeah, I won't add anything, just that we would really appreciate the support to move forward, because we're right, we need to hear the voices of the people who are experiencing this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. I'm going to renew my motion to re-refer House File 900 as recommended to the Housing, Finance, and Policy Committee. We're going to go to a roll call vote. Chair votes aye.
Schultz votes aye. Vice Chair Bonner.
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright.
No.
Albright, no. Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle.
No.
Burkle, no. Representative Fisher.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick.
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen?
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Keel?
Keel, no.
Keel, no. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller? I'll come back, Representative Mueller. Representative Knorr?
Knorr, yes.
Knorr, yes. Representative Novotny?
Some of the tests right now.
I didn't catch that.
I have to pass for a second.
Pass.
Oh, pass first. Okay, thank you. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, no.
Pearson, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Robbins?
No.
Robbins, no. Representative Sandell?
Yes.
Sandell, yes. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Mueller?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Novotny, would you like to place a vote?
I am a no. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. That's 11 ayes and 8 nays, Chair Schultz. Have a good weekend, members.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion prevails. And with that, members, we are adjourned. I will see everybody on Tuesday at 10:30. Have a great weekend.